subtract, winding back to an old-fashioned shack along the road to Gundagai, where the gum trees are growing and the Murrumbidgee's flowing beneath the sunny sky. There's my mother and daddy awaiting for me, and the pals of my childhood once more I will see. And no more will I roam, 'cause I'm heading right for a home along the road to Gundagai. Here we go.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 153. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around on Australia Day 2015, we are doing an Australian movie special. The first one is an historical drama done by Ealing, an English company, but set around Australian themes, and it is Eureka Stockade, starring Chips Rafferty and Peter Finch. Then we go to 1978 for a look at Newsreel Cameraman and Newsfront, starring Bill Hunter.
Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it.
Hey, how's everybody doing? We're doing pretty okay here. I haven't watched many movies lately because I have been working madly on renovating the man cave. I used to have all of the DVDs stacked horizontally, too deep on the shelves. And I couldn't really see what I had in the back row of that too deep stack in the shelves. So I had a bit of a brainstorm and decided that I needed narrower wood and that I was going to stack the DVDs vertically in the man cave. So I kind of priced out getting new planks to put on the shelf because I have wall-mounted shelves with pine planks across them. And it would have cost me, say, $150, roughly $150 to get new wood for that, cut to length and width and all that kind of stuff. But I then went into a big hardware store and saw that they had table saws for sale for $150. So I thought, hello, I'm going to do something weird here. So I bought myself a table saw, assembled it underneath the veranda, and cut the double wide shelves I already had into single wide shelves for DVDs and mounted them up. That then required me, of course, to unstack all of the everything off books and DVDs off the old shelves, cut them down to size with a little help from Sal, put the shelves back up, and then categorize and alphabetize a couple of thousand DVDs. This is a non-trivial task, but I got there eventually, kept the air conditioning on when I got really hot, did it all in a mad day of effort, which included a full day of working from home. And to be honest with you, it's looking really good. I've got the Xbox set up slightly differently than I had before. And being me and having blind spots occasionally, it didn't occur to me that I could play DVDs via an Xbox 360. And I can. So basically, the man cave now has some really nice storage. Everything is in categorized and alphabetized order. The Xbox is sitting there so I can watch movies in here as well. I can also play a lot of games. I've been playing a bit of Halo Reach lately. But it's starting to get to the stage where the man cave is looking pretty bloody good. And it's become a space that suits my passions, basically books, movies, pissing around with video games, and just chilling out. And it's become a really nice sanctuary for me. And I've enjoyed that a lot. So I haven't watched a lot of movies over the last couple of weeks because I've been planning and executing all of that. But there's probably three I want to mention that I watched. Two more than the other one. But I've got a backlist now of things that I want to watch and that I have copies of, but I haven't had time to watch. First one is, I saw Expendables 3, the third in the Expendables series about geriatric mercenaries, starring Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Harrison Ford, Jason Statham, who's the baby of the bunch, really, even though there's a whole new bunch of young action stars like Kellan Lutz and other guys in for the game as well. And, yeah, it's pretty much what's on the label. Nice meathead action film. It's one of those things that really doesn't... It isn't going to win an award for anything except for having the most number of birthdays among the major cast members. But, yeah, so I watched that, and it's one of those ones I picked up secondhand out of a DVD vending machine. And it's not marvelous stuff, but it's the kind of thing, now and then you want to kind of chill out, not use your brain too much and just watch a bit of action. And there's a kind of go-to movie for that kind of thing. I also saw Ron Howard's movie from 2013, Rush, starring Chris Hemsworth and Daniel Brühl. And, yeah, it's about Niki Lauda and James Hunt and Formula One racing in the 1970s. So it's got that 1970s style, some good 1970s haircuts and fashions and attitudes and things like that. And it's pretty good. I think Hemsworth's very good. And Daniel Brühl is very, very good as Niki Lauda. So they're both really... acting their guts out there. And apart from that, the story, of course, if you know the arc of the story, that's fine. But if you don't, I'm not going to spoil it. But there's some shit goes down that's pretty gruesome, particularly around the Nürburgring. And, yeah, that's a good movie. It works really well, but it seems to be a little bit technical. There's more kind of technology than heart in the movie in some ways. Even though the acting is good and the characters are interesting, it does have a feel of kind of being a Lego effort in the sense that it's little bricks put together to make a larger thing. And, yeah, there's something about it that kind of goes a bit by the books. That's possibly because Ron Howard, being a very mainstream Hollywood director, it doesn't go to any kind of really wild and interesting places the way it might have. And the other film that I saw was, I already watched Captain America the Winter Soldier again because I couldn't be fucked getting off the couch or changing the channel, to be honest with you. And I really liked the way that they're layering the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I'm not going to talk much about that because I've talked about it enough in Martian Drive-In podcast lately. But they're the kind of three movies I've been watching. Watched a bit of episodic TV and things like that. But for the most part, I've actually been doing physical things, which is slightly unusual for me. But that's what I've been up to. Now, the two movies I'm doing this time, I decided I was going to do some Australian movies. And the two that I first thought of were the two that I ended up doing, which was 1948's Eureka Stockade, directed by Harry Watt, and the 1978 movie about newsreel cameramen in the 1940s and 1950s in Australia, and that is Newsfront, directed by Phil Noyce and starring Bill Hunter, Chris Hayward, Wendy Hughes, and a cast of other really fine Australian actors. And I think both films have got a bit to say about Australia as a culture and a little bit about Australia as a nation. One looking at it from a 19th century viewpoint and the other looking at it from a 20th century viewpoint. Now, I know I'm taking a little bit of risk with this one because I crunched the numbers on Paleo Cinema Podcast and found out that 2% of my listening audience is from Australia. Now, I'm not sure why that is, but thank you to America, Canada and Germany in particular for really upping the stats there. But Australia, not so much. I'm going to have to maybe... I don't know, skywrite the name of the podcast somewhere over a large sporting event or have a Zeppelin with the name painted on the side or something like that. Anybody who wants to contribute hundreds of thousands of dollars to those particular endeavours, please feel free to do so. But, yeah, it's really interesting that here, not so much. Overseas, I'm really happy with the stats. So I'm taking a risk. I'm doing Australian movies, both of which are available for purchase. If you go to Umbrella Entertainment, if you just Google that, they'll sell you the discs for it, and they're nice people to deal with. I bought both of my copies from them. They will be Australian region coded, but anybody who doesn't have a multi-zone DVD or Blu-ray player really needs to go out and get one. It's just not worth not doing, because you're going to miss out on a lot of really good stuff if you don't. So anyway, I'm going to... by the way, the track I played right at the start of the podcast is an iconic Australian song, which appears in Newsfront as well. And that was Slim Dusty's version of The Road to Gundagai. In Newsfront, it's played slightly more ironically, and I will discuss that when I talk about Newsfront. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I do get back, we're going to do these chronologically, and I'm going to look at Harry Watt's 1948 movie about the Eureka Rebellion, which is Eureka Stockade, starring Chips Rafferty and Peter Finch. I respectfully acknowledge the past and present traditional owners of the land on which I am podcasting, the Kurrung Jangbalak people. It is a privilege to be podcasting in Kurrung Jangbalak country. Eureka Stockade is a kind of a movie that conflicts me for a number of very, very different reasons. Conflicts me coming at a whole bunch of different tangents. Firstly, Eureka Stockade and the Eureka Rebellion has been used by white Australian racists to support their causes as they see them. And therefore, the Eureka flag, which is a Southern Cross kind of flag, has been almost preempted by those kind of groups. It's a pretty safe bet that if you see a guy walking down the street in Australia with the Eureka flag tattooed on him, he has some opinions which are less than enlightened. So I'm conflicted about it for that reason. Another one is that I've got a couple of problems with the movie, and I'll discuss those a little bit later. And the other thing, too, is it tells the story quite historically accurately, but through the movie only got made because of, not because of Australians, but because of English people. And there's that aspect of it as well, that there wasn't really a film industry in Australia after World War II. And unfortunately, our stories had to be told by other people for that reason. There's a lot of complicated reasons why that's the case. But this, in a weird kind of sense, is almost cultural appropriation. But anyway, a guy called Harry Watt was sent out by Ealing Studios after the war to make movies in Australia and Africa, basically in the colonies and in the dominions, for domestic consumption in England. There was a bit of money floating around, so Harry Watt made a couple of movies in Africa. He made The Overlanders in Australia with Chips Rafferty, which was very successful. And he then later on went to make a movie that I spoke about in a very early Paleo Cinema podcast, which was The Siege of Pinchgut with Aldo Ray in it, set on Sydney Harbour. So in between that, the Eureka Stockade came up. Now, the Eureka Rebellion was a rebellion of gold miners in Ballarat, which is about 80 kilometres away from where I'm sitting now, against an unfair tax, in a sense. Gold was found in Ballarat and Bendigo and a number of other places that aren't very, very far away from where I'm sitting now. And gold fever struck, particularly Victoria as a colony then, the state I'm living in at the moment. And basically, the state was going bankrupt. The colony was going bankrupt because everybody kind of stopped working in the cities, stopped working in manufacturing and agricultural work and all those other things to go and dig gold out of the ground and get rich by doing that. I'm not too sure whether there were too many people who did that. I know a lot of shopkeepers got rich and people who sold spades and shovels and picks and other things. But I'm not too sure too many gold miners got and stayed rich by doing it. So they all went out to the gold fields. A bunch of Chinese labourers came to the gold fields from China. They had to walk 600 kilometres from Robe in South Australia because the authorities wouldn't let them into Victoria to get off at the docks here. So the ships dropped them off in Robe in South Australia on the coast just south of Adelaide. and they walk 600 kilometres across the bush to get to the Ballarat goldfields. In fact, you can now walk the same trail. And that's one of the other aspects of the gold mines around Ballarat and Bendigo and Creswick and other places like that. They were incredibly multicultural because men came from all around the world to work in those gold fields. There were Canadians there. A whole bunch of Canadians became a part of the rebellion. There were Americans, there were Scots, Englishmen, Europeans, Chinese people. A lot of the Chinese people ended up doing market gardens and farms and things like that to supply food to the miners. And in fact, Chinese restaurants were opened up in the gold fields for exactly that reason. So it's an incredible kind of melting pot mixture of people. And the colony was slowly going bankrupt. So the governor at the time, La Trobe, and later on Hotham, both of which are names for places in Victoria to this very day, set out a proclamation saying that all miners needed to have licences of 30 shillings per month from 1st of September 1851. Now, a lot of the miners were kind of didn't have a lot of money with them. They were basically living on extremely thin means, and the imposition of a 30 shilling per month license was a big imposition on people who hadn't really found very much gold yet. There was definitely gold there, and a lot of people did find some, but it seemed unfair for them to be charged for just digging in the ground, digging a hole in the ground at 30 shillings per month. So on the 26th of August in 1851, there was a rally of miners who opposed the fee. And in December, the government announced that they intended to triple the license fee to £3 a month from the 1st of January 1852. And that was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. The miners really couldn't do it. And the other thing, too, was that the police force in Victoria, well, a lot of the coppers had gone gold mining. So the only police they could find to police this thing and to police the licensing thieves were basically criminals and thugs and psychopaths and sadists and things like that. So when people were arrested for not having a license or having their license expired, the kind of people who were arresting them weren't the best of people to be doing that. And so it became very much a civil rights issue. Now, there are a couple of aspects to this. And there's been a lot of historic discussion because this is a kind of crucial point in Australian society where we had our first real big rebellion of working men against authority. And the big issue, the big divide between the different groups who were protesting against the mining tax was that some of them were just there, just thought the tax was unfair, but other people thought that they wanted a fair go and they wanted to live in Australia for a long time, whereas that was mostly the Australians and the English and Scottish and the Irish and the Welsh and all the other groups there. But there are a lot of people that were just there for the money and didn't really have any loyalty or any intention of staying in Australia. But they were united together by the unfairness of the tax. And the big thing that triggered the problems was the murder of a Scottish miner called James Scobie at the Eureka Hotel. And 10 days later, a mob of miners gathered at the hotel to protest things, and the hotel burnt down, and the owners fled. And there was a big riot there. And all of this led to the formation of the Ballarat Reform League, and a bunch of miners formed a stockade and swore allegiance to the flag of the Southern Cross, and they basically wanted their rights and their liberties. They were being oppressed quite severely at the time. And the Battle of the Eureka Stockade occurred. So in 1949, the movie came out, starring Chips Rafferty as Peter Lawler, the leader of the Eureka Rebellion. Let's see who else we've got. Peter Illing was another important was another actor in there, playing one of the very important characters, a guy called Raffaello Carboni, who'd been with Garibaldi in Italy and was very much a kind of socialist. And Raffaello Carboni is one of the few people to write down their first hand impressions of the Eureka Rebellion. In fact, his is the kind of go-to first book that you look at it. It's in Project Gutenberg, by the way. If you look up Raffaello Carboni in Project Gutenberg, you can read his book, which is very, very florid, about the Eureka Rebellion. And he was an Italian. He ended up dying in Italy. But he was quite important in the rebellion. In fact, there were a whole bunch of... There were 12 guys arrested ultimately for the rebellion. 26 people died during the rebellion, 6 coppers and 20 of the miners. But among the people arrested for it were a black American guy from Baltimore. There were Irishmen, Englishmen, Scotsmen, Australians. Basically, again, that melting pot and that kind of weird mixture of cultures working side by side to dig in the gold fields. There were also indigenous people in the gold fields. We can't forget that as well. A lot of them were, there were some that were police trackers working on the other side of things from the rebels. There were also indigenous people who were the miners. There were a lot of indigenous people who were the wives of miners as well. And also people just basically... Everybody you could imagine being in this place at this time was there during the rebellion. And the rebellion was slapped down pretty hard by the military and by the police of the colony at the time. Peter Lawler was injured during the rebellion and ended up having his arm amputated from the injury. He escaped and ended up being a member of parliament. Not quite as radical as people would have liked him to be. And he, in fact, voted against the one big thing that came out of the rebellion, which was universal male white suffrage. In Victoria, it was the first, about the third place in the world that said that everybody should get a vote as long as you were a white and a guy, which is the start of a lot of civil rights that everybody enjoys now. Now, the, getting specifically to the movie, and I'll get out of the history just a little bit. Tips Rafferty, it's Peter Lawler's in there, Peter Reeling, Gordon Jackson, the English actor that people might remember from The Professionals, as Tom Kennedy, a young Scotsman, Grant Taylor, another Australian character actor, Peter Finch's Humphrey, one of the people who was arrested for the Eureka thing, is in there. Finchie's in there with an enormous beard, he looks like a hipster. Kevin Brennan, let's see, who else is in there that I know? Oh yeah, Al Thomas played Scobie, the guy who was killed by the publican. Now, Al Thomas, a lot of people don't remember, but I remember him because he used to do a kids program in the 1960s when I was a little kid. And he was this kind of short, nuggety, leprechaunish kind of guy who did a children's show, I think on Channel 7. And we all used to watch that. And I don't even remember the name of the show, but I remember that Al Thomas was on. He was a Scottish guy who came out to Australia before World War II and did a lot of stage and radio work. He was known as a radio comedian during the war. And in fact, his wife was a very, very attractive woman. And she was the number one female Australian pin-up for soldiers during World War II. But leaving that aside, it's kind of interesting to see how historically accurate this movie is, and based on what they knew of history at the time. You've got to remember, people dig in, find more resources and dig up more information as time goes on about historical events. It is quite historically accurate. They get the both sides of the equation really well covered. The fact that the colony was going bankrupt and they needed to do something about getting money, and then they, in order to enforce the laws they created, they ended up with a brutal and out-of-control police force to do it. And that, of course, led to the rebellion. It was more the way people were treated. Yeah, people weren't happy about the mining licenses, but when the traps came around and started arresting them and beating people on the head for no good reason, there was no real rule of law there. There was only one gang of thugs riding over everybody else. Now, the movie was, I mean, I was a bit surprised when I read this about the movie. The movie is quite historically accurate, so we'll leave it there. It wasn't filmed around Ballarat because the landscape had changed so much. Ballarat became a major regional city and still is to this day. In fact, I've got friends living up there. And so they couldn't film anywhere near it because the landscape was totally changed. In fact, if you go up to Sovereign Hill in Ballarat, which is around where the mine diggings were, there's no way you could realistically, without a lot of CGI stuff now, film anything to do with the Eureka stockade there. So instead, they went up to Singleton in New South Wales, which is about 1,000 kilometres north of here. They found a valley just outside Singleton and built an entire town from scratch for the making of the movie. The movie, I mean, there were a few historical societies who were a bit unhappy with it. The design of the Eureka flag that appears in the movie is not the same as the real Eureka flag. And Peter Lawler's great-grandson complained about Chips Rafferty's casting, claimed he was nothing like Peter Lawler, which is a bit odd because how many great-grandsons know what their grandfathers were like? But there was a problem also with actors' equity in Australia because they placed a black ban on film contracts issued by Ealing Studios, Columbia Pictures and Charles Chauvel. Because basically there weren't enough major roles being played by Australians apart from Chips Rafferty. They brought in English actors for some things. But that was eventually sorted out. And the interiors of the movie were filmed at Pagewood and CineSound Studios. Now, CineSound is something you're going to hear more about when I talk about Newsfront. CineSound was a big newsreel company at the time. And Pagewood, in the 19-teens and 1920s into the 1930s, was the major movie studio for Australia back when Australia had a film industry. And so the only place they could really film the interiors were at Pagewood. But it hadn't really been in good repair since World War II, so they had to do a lot of renovations on the studios in order to get them working accurately as film studios. Well, not accurately, but working well as film studios. They also had a lot of problem with weather because the weather either rained a lot or it got really hot. And there were some other problems as well. Let's see what else happened during the making of this. A member of the crew was involved in a car accident with a retired policeman, and the retired cop had died, so they had problems with that. One of the cast members was found drunk taking off all his clothes in a public street. There was the main female star, Jane Barrett, who plays a school teacher in this, was hospitalised after an insect bite. So it took well over a year to get everything done, and the final budget was around 200,000 quid, which is the same amount, I'm reading this from Wikipedia, by the way, was the same amount Ealing had intended to spend on 6 films shot over 2 years in Australia. And yeah, so the movie is problematic now. But the big problem I've got with the movie, I like the fact that it's historically accurate. I think that it works well as a tale to be told. But the big problem we've got with the movie is Chips Rafferty as Peter Lawler. Now, Chips Rafferty, I've got a lot of respect for as an actor. I really like a lot of the work he did. I like Bitter Springs and I like The Overlanders as well. I think he was great in those roles. He was really good as the father-in-law in There A Weird Mob, Michael Powell's movie from 1966. And, of course, he was tremendous in his last film role as the town copper in another movie I'm going to have to talk about on the podcast at some stage, which is Ted Kotcheff's Wake in Fright. So I've got a lot of respect for Chips Rafferty as an actor. I don't have a lot of respect for his work in Eureka Stockade, and his is the one real problem I have with this film, apart from all the cultural imperialism of having an English company make the movies rather than an Australian company. We weren't willing to invest in our own cultural products at the time, and there's still an argument that Australia isn't really willing to do that.
So they've brought in the soldiers, eh? That means more arrests, more digger hunts. And the trouble is, this time they're right.
We ask him to be our spokesman, and he speaks for them.
I speak for myself. Spokesman? You don't want a spokesman. You had two at Hottam's, and the men they were speaking for went behind their back, and I was at Bentley's the other night. I saw all their hopes go up in those flames.
You must have patience, Peter. I beg of you to have patience. Great works are going to happen. I know you are sad because things are not going your way, and so are we all as sensible men. But do stay with us, Peter.
I'll let him go. He's no longer with us.
Keep quiet, Vern. You are all sound and no sense.
We need your advice, Peter. Think it over. You know where to find me.
Yeah, as you can hear from that, he's not very good. He almost seems like he's slightly sedated. Whereas Peter Lawler was a man who gathered together a mob of people, incredibly diverse people from all corners of the earth, and got them to all believe in one thing and to all support each other in fighting an injustice. And really, Chips Rafferty's energy levels in this movie are just entirely wrong for that sort of thing. In 1984, there was a television miniseries done of Eureka Stockade as well, with Brian Brown playing Peter Lawler, and that one worked a lot better and had a little more time to tell the story. But this one I like for a couple of reasons, but not leaving aside the Chips Rafferty stuff. I like the fact that somebody is telling an Australian story about the fight for justice. There are a number of people in a number of ways in this brown, unpleasant land who are fighting for justice. From people from our Australian of the Year, Rosie Batty, who's fighting against domestic violence because her son was killed by her ex-husband a year ago, and she became Australian of the Year this year for her fight against that, to the plight of refugees in this country, to people trying to get medical help and fighting against a government that seems to only see, that sees money as the only reason for everything in the world. So there are still fights for injustice, against injustice, sorry. There are fights for injustice as well, but there are fights against injustice that are still going on a daily basis in this and every other country. And we're drawn to tales about that, particularly where there is some form of a win. And in the Eureka Rebellion, the win was a change in the laws to enable everybody to have a say in government. Well, at least at the first point, men, and then around the turn of the century, women got the vote as well. But there was that first step in this country towards universal suffrage. And it's an important story to tell. It's been adopted by any number of people. And particularly, for some reason, right-wing historians and right-wing politicians tend to diminish the importance of the Eureka Rebellion in Australia's civil rights history, possibly for their own reasons and possibly because they don't want to be on the other end of the stick. But I think it's an important story to tell. I do feel genuinely sad that a lot of the Eureka stuff is being adopted by people who support racist causes and jingoistic causes. I don't think it's about that at all. I think it's about freedoms and acknowledging people who fought for those freedoms, even in a dusty, dirty little town that basically only really existed because there was a certain mineral in the ground. But Eureka Stockade is it's a part of Australian film history in that sense, and there was a whole bunch of equipment brought out from England by Harry Watt and the Yealing team, and a lot of Australian technicians learned how to use that equipment, and that's the upside to this from a local viewpoint, training people up to do what they have to do. And the weird thing is that there still has to be, people still have to go overseas to get a lot of this training at times. We do have the Australian Film and Television School and a bunch of other places that are teaching this stuff now. But for instance, the director of The Babadook, Jennifer Kent, went overseas to get experience to be able to make that film. Lee Whannell and James Wan, two Australians who got together and put together Saw movies, can't really do what they want to do in Australia. The Sperrig brothers have gone overseas to make films. They do come back to actually film them, but they go to America for financing because they can't get financing here. And we're at risk of losing a lot of talented people to other countries in order to for them to do what they want to do with their careers, and it's not right. And I think that one of the lovely things we've got at the moment is that resurgence in Australian film. I mentioned it the last time in the last Martian Driving podcast that we're having a bit of a renaissance in Australian genre films, because making movies is something you can do a lot cheaper than you used to be able to do. And there are new voices coming in and new people showing us, telling us new stories, which do still have a flavour of Australia about it. And, of course, the Australia in the times of the Eureka Stockade was a very different place than it is now. In fact, the Australia at the time of Newsfront is very different, and there are a couple of acknowledgements of that in that movie. But I think it's important to tell these stories, and I like the fact that the movie exists, even if I think that the movie really doesn't have a lead that makes it work. In fact, there wasn't one stage Harry Watt was thinking of replacing Chips Rafferty with Peter Finch, who later on went to do one or two other things, including a little movie called Network. Again, he went overseas to get famous. He started out doing things in England and then, of course, America, ultimately. But, and in this movie, he has maybe five or six scenes, but he does make an impression during those scenes as well. I did see Peter Finch in a really interesting movie called The Trials of Oscar Wilde, but I definitely think that Peter Lawler was a role that Peter Finch could have carried a lot better than Chips Rafferty did, even though I do have a lot of respect for Chips Rafferty for a lot of reasons. I think there were roles he was excellent in, and there were times when he was the only person speaking out aloud and speaking out clearly and getting any media presence at all to speak in on behalf of an Australian film industry. Even if there is every bit of a story that he was a bastard in a lot of ways and not as pleasant a person as you'd like, but he was speaking out for having a film industry. And I'm in favour of every country having its own film industry. I like international movies. I like movies from all over the world. But I like the fact that one of the things we should be doing, well, not a fact, but one of the things we should be doing is letting each country have its own voice and let each country have its own industry, portraying stories that are its stories. And you're not even just countries, cultures. Cultures should tell their own stories. And I think that we as movie watchers are nothing but enriched by having those stories told. Yes, we're not going to catch up with all of them, but we're going to catch up with some of them, and we're going to see things we wouldn't see and see people who view the world in a way that we don't know about otherwise. And that's why I think it's important to have films from a particular nation or a particular culture's viewpoint, because it makes the soup of cinema richer in doing that. But having said that, I'm going to take a break now, and then we're going to get to 1978 to talk about the 1950s with Phil Noyce's classic Australian film and one of maybe the top three Australian films of all time for me. And that is Newsfront, starring Bill Hunter, Wendy Hughes, Chris Hayward, Brian Brown, and Johnny Ewart, a whole bunch of other Australian character actors. Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention this. In America, a shortened version of Eureka Stockade was brought out with the name of Massacre Hill. So if you're looking for it in America, you may find Massacre Hill somewhere, but it makes it sound like an Audie Murphy Western, and it really isn't that. But if you do want to go Umbrella Entertainment, type that into a search engine, and you'll find the movie. You'll also find a copy of Newsfront there, and they're running for about $10 each Australian. And they're worth having. Brings us on to Newsfront, 1978 movie directed by Philip Noyce, a director whose name you might remember. He's done any number of films. He did Dead Calm, Blind Fury with Rutger Hauer, Patriot Games, Sliver, Clear and Present Danger, The Saint, which is a spy movie from 97 starring Val Kilmer that I've got a bit of a soft spot for, Bone Collector, Rabbit Proof Fence, The Quiet American, and did Salt with Angelina Jolie in 2010. So basically he's got a long career. He did a number of movies in Australia, started out from the bottom and worked his way up. But he made Newsfront in 1978, for which I am forever grateful, because I think it's just one of the best Australian movies of all time. It stars Bill Hunter as Len McGuire, who's a newsreel cameraman, in post-war Australia, and it goes through 8 years of the life of Phil, his friends, his enemies, and the Cinetone Newsreel Company, while they produce newsreels from 1948 until 1956 at the Melbourne Olympics. His brother, played by Gerard Kennedy, Frank, used to work for the same company as him, but now works for the other side, the other company. There are two different newsreel filmmaking companies in the place. So Frank's working for the opposition in that sense, and then eventually goes off to Hollywood to make his fortune. Meanwhile, Frank and his sometimes lover, Amy, played by Wendy Hughes, have a parting of the ways. And Bill Hunter's, well, Len Maguire, the character Bill Hunter plays, assistant, is played by Chris Hayward. He's a young guy called Chris Hewitt, who's an English emigrant who's come to Australia because he wanted to become a newsreel film guy, a newsreel cameraman. And I'll just play a little bit of him, Bill Hunter, and Chris Hayward talking about why Chris Hewitt, the character Chris Hayward plays, came out to Australia. They also go on to speak a little bit about post-war politics, and Len, the character played by Bill Hunter, is very much a Labor Party left-wing Catholic and has great respect for Labor Prime Ministers.
Mr. Mac?
Yeah?
That bloke, your brother?
Yeah.
Why did he leave the company?
Because he's a disloyal, self-seeking bastard, that's why.
Well, why shouldn't he leave? I mean, if the money's better.
Well, son, if you don't know that, I can't tell you.
Well, I don't know a lot of things, do I? I mean, I'm new around here. I'm a, what do you call it, a moral primitive.
True. Too true.
Yeah, well, the company took us on when we were broke. And our folks were starving.
Good morning, Senator.
The both of us, Frank first, then me. Sweeping floors, worked our way out. Now, the company didn't have to do that, did they?
No,
but they did.
What a depression, was it?
Yeah, the depression.
Well, how long are you on the dole then?
We didn't go on the dole. Not the Maguires. The battling Maguires. Must have been mad.
Oh, well, you know, here we worked down the tube, kipping on the platform, stacked us in like sardines, they did. You come up in the morning, check out whose house got bombed. Yeah, it felt really good some mornings coming up there knowing you'd survived in amongst all that destruction. But there were the cameramen, you see, they were there, getting it all down and dodging in and out amongst the bombs and the fires and that. And I thought, well, that's for me, ain't it? I mean, so that's why I came out here. We'd take too bloody long in England. Everything takes too bloody long there.
Yes, well, it's not exactly overnight here either, digger.
Yeah, but there's more chances here, ain't there? I mean, more chances in a new young country.
What do you think of Ben Chifley?
He's a bit common, ain't he?
Common?
Well, 6 years ago, he was still an engine driver.
Ben Chifley's the second best Prime Minister we ever had, mate. Don't you forget that.
Oh, yeah, who's the first then?
Mate?
Who's the first then? Just so I know, like, you know. Well, for purposes of social intercourse.
John Curtin, mate. And about John Curtin, you don't get witty. You get me?
So Len's very much a old-school Labour lefty. Traditional Catholic. His wife is very Catholic. Faye, played by Angela Punch McGregor. And they have three kids in quick succession. And as the movie progresses and as the years progress, they drift further and further apart until they eventually part. But one of the great things about the Len character in this is there's an innate kindness to him. Even to his enemies, when he swears at people, the things he says are the mildest of profanities in that sense. And he's got a kind of a kindness about him, which is very much underplayed. Even with his enemies, he'll diffuse the enmity with a joke now and then, and with wit. And then not the kind of overstated wit, but a kind of very dry, laconic Australian sort of wit where there's a rival cameraman played by John Ewart, another fantastic Australian actor who left us too soon. He was also in The Picture Show Man with John Mellion and Rod Taylor back in the day. But John Ewart is really nice, playing a cameraman who's 10 years older than Len is. Works for the other company, and they've got a friendly rivalry about them, and eventually they become allies of a sort. And, it's interesting because a lot of these cameramen, including Len, have got through World War II and did a lot of work as war photographers, as war cameramen in that sense. And there is a scene where on Anzac Day they put together a documentary. Brian Brown's character, who's a film editor in there, puts together a documentary about one of the film cameramen who didn't come back, and that's a real-life cameraman called Damien Parra, whose movie, Kokoda Frontline, won an Oscar as Best Documentary. It totally shit on even John Huston's war documentaries. Kokoda Frontline was the first Australian movie to ever win an Oscar. And Newsfront respects that and shows Damien Parra's work and shows just how close he filmed the Australian soldiers from No Man's Land in between them and the Japanese in New Guinea. Totally fearless, and unfortunately he did die during the war as a casualty of Japanese sniper. But they throw in so much history because that's a time of enormous change in Australia. They throw in so much history through the eyes of the documentaries using a combination of stuff they film themselves and genuine newsreel footage of the time and seamlessly blending the two together. The cinematography in this one was fantastic for that. It blends together new stuff with old stuff really well. In fact, the movie starts out with something that's very pointed. And I think that apart from Phil Noyce, all credit should go to the script writers, including one of Australia's great curmudgeons, Bob Ellis, for doing that. Now, it starts out with some newsreel footage just after the war of Chico Marx playing Waltzing Matilda on a piano with a bunch of Australians around there singing with him. And it's just the kind of start of the Americanization of Australia, and it portrays it in a very interesting way by having that bit of newsreel footage play before the start of the titles in the movie. And again, there are other bits and pieces that come through just showing their cultural imperialism, including the arc of the character Frank, played by Gerard Kennedy, another fine Australian actor, who comes back from the States after a certain period of time with an American accent and an American girlfriend and American attitudes that don't really sit well with his brother Len, who's stayed in Australia and is doing really fine work as a newsreel cameraman. One of the great things about that role is that in cinema in general, you don't often see grown-up men. You see men doing stupid things and men conflicted and men who are angry and men who perpetuate childhood to their deaths. But Len McGuire in Newsfront is a genuine grown-up. He's lived through the war. He's lived through the Depression. He hasn't let it make him less of a man. He's made it deepen his character. And that's really interesting. Even when he and his wife are disagreeing and eventually break up, there's no shouting and no violence at all. They do say some unkind things to each other, but there's an essential decency which is at the heart of his character, which makes it really interesting. But they go through a number of historical events of the time and show it through the lens of the camera. The Red X trials, which was a big motorcycle, it was almost like a cannonball run across Australia, and it was a big media event in the early 1950s. Celebrities went there. In fact, you see a little bit of newsreel footage of one of the great radio celebrities of Australia, Jack Davey, at the Red X trial, basically bush bashing their way across the country in old cars, just as an amusement and to raise money for charity. So they've got that as a part of it. They have the Maitland floods in the 1950s, which is a really crucial part of the film. And they seamlessly blend footage of a real flood in newsreel footage of the real flood in the 1950s with footage of the characters in the story really well. And the way they did that was they created the top halves of the main street of Maitland in Narrabeen Lagoon outside Sydney, and then had a whole bunch of motors running to simulate the water currents. And they just built the top bits of the building, various buildings, and had the guys film that. And it blends incredibly well with the original footage. There's a whole bunch of stuff in the movie as well about the change of attitudes. Right at the start, the first thing that you see Len and Chris filming is a migrant ship of European migrants coming to Australia, Italians and Germans and Greeks and all sorts of people like that. So they're showing that post-war change in immigration patterns and how that's going to change the way Australia is, and not in a negative way. And I found that as time went on, from 1978 till now, that part of the movie resonates a lot more because I've said this before in the podcast, and I really am sorry if I'm harping on about this, but Australia's attitude to people in need has worsened in the decades since the 1940s and indeed since the 1970s. And so that part plays with an extra poignancy when you watch it these days compared to when I first saw it in 1978. It's shown without knowing it, and then with absolutely no way of knowing what they were showing us. They were showing us something that was changing, that was going to change for the worse in the future. And that makes that, for any compassionate Australian, a bit of a sad part of this movie in a totally unexpected way. Then we come to the character of Amy, played by Wendy Hughes, who's an independent woman. She basically, behind the scenes, runs the newsreel company. She's the person with the good instincts, with the good eye, with the knowledge to make things work. But because she's a woman in 1940s, 1950s Australia, she never gets to be in the executive office in that sense. But she lives a life on her own terms. She has a long-term affair with Frank before he leaves, and then later on moves in with Len after Len's marriage breaks up. Which isn't to say there isn't a certain sexism in Len, but he does respect Amy's opinions, even with that sexism. And one of the interesting things, and one of the great things about Wendy Hughes' acting, is that you get a lot of her character from her acting rather than from the dialogue. Though there is some dialogue there that really does give us an insight into her, even though she's not one of the focal characters of the piece. And one of the other things that I really like is the way she reacts to Len and the way she acknowledges his decency. There's a scene when Frank comes back from America with his new American accent, his new American girlfriend, where Len treats the girlfriend with respect and he's charming. And even though she's very gauche and very kind of loudly and brassily American, Len's kindness to her gets acknowledged by Amy with just a look, and it's a lovely piece of acting. Wendy Hughes was one of the Australian actors who, she had a slight career in America, but really didn't get the roles that she deserved. She's a really fine actor. She did a number of really good Australian films, Peterson being one of them, Careful He Might Hear You. There are a whole bunch of different roles in Wendy Hughes' career that show her talent as an actor. But unfortunately, she's died about a year and a half ago of cancer. And she is one of the Australian female actors that never did anything badly. And in Newsfront, she looks great, of course, in the period clothing and a very beautiful woman. But I keep having my eye drawn to what she's doing while other people are talking in the movie, and you see a different aspect of the film by watching it that way, which I kind of thought was really cool, and all respect to her for that. Angela Punch McGregor as well, in a very thankless role as a kind of conservative Catholic wife who it would be very easy to hate were the role not played that well. There's a scene but during the communist scares in the 1950s, there was going to be a referendum in Australia about communism and banning the Communist Party. And she has a piece where their parish priest is handing out how to vote pamphlets supporting the referendum, in favour of banning communism and jailing people who two members of parliament say are communists, which was what was going to happen. And she kind of supports the priest, and she doesn't want to be embarrassed by her husband refusing to take some of the pamphlets to hand out. And it's a very thankless role, but there is an arc to Faye's life and to Faye's character and her coming to terms with the changes in society that occur in the 40s and 1950s, which I kind of liked. They don't villainise her in that sense. There's also the bit where Chris meets a girl in the country and they get married. And him and Lorna Leslie play that really nicely. I mean, they're at a kind of a bush dance and during the Red X trials and hook up for the night, and she turns up a couple of months later on his doorstep pregnant. But it's a really nice, sweet little piece of this movie. And there are some sweet bits in this movie, even though it's a large-scale story in that sense and covers 8 very big years in Australian history. There is still time for those little grace notes of character, which I really like a lot. It was made for only $600,000 too, which even in 1978 wasn't a lot of money. But they do fantastically well in painting the broad picture and showing those changes. The biggest change, of course, being the advent of television, which before television, the newsreels were the way people got their news. Once a week, they'd go to the cinema and they'd have a 15-minute to 20-minute newsreel, which updated them on either world events or things that were happening in Australia. Radio could only convey so much, but the newsreels before the advent of television in 1956 were the means by which people got their news, and they were important to the culture and to the society in a sense. You could see things that were happening. You could see the Queen coming to Australia. You could see the Red X trials. You could see celebrities. You could see politics. You could see various wars Australians were involved in. The newsreels lasted well into the 1960s, and in fact, I can remember going to the cinema and seeing newsreels. Yes, I'd seen the stuff on television before, but the newsreel footage being not in low-res 1960s television and having the time to edit and explain really were a better means at the time of showing certain events. And they were always a lot of fun to see. Unfortunately, they did die out, but they really, they were an important step towards what we have now. And well, let's ignore Fox News, but we didn't have 24-hour news channels. We had once a week 15 to 20 minutes of edited footage by some very gutsy people. They go into bushfire areas, they go into conflict zones, they go into natural disasters just to show us what was happening with those things and to show us what people were capable of and were doing. And this movie gives a lot of love and respect to the men and women who were involved in doing that. But again, it comes back to just round things off for the whole lot. It shows another aspect of Australia's character, which is giving people a fair go and also adapting to change. I mean, Frank adapts to change a lot better than Len does. And there's a great epiphany at the Melbourne Olympics at the end where the differences between the characters of Len and Frank, the two brothers, is portrayed in no uncertain terms. And Len's left with an uncertain future. Television is coming along, and he's a newsreel cameraman. He's not a television cameraman. He doesn't know the technology. The technologies are very different between the two. And he's kind of marches off into an uncertain future. But then there's this great thing at the end where they show news footage for the years after 1956, right up until the late 1970s when the film was made. So they show what happened when LBJ came out to Australia to support the Vietnam War. They show Harold Holt, the Prime Minister at the time. They show Gough Whitlam, the Prime Minister in the 1970s, who changed so much in Australia. And that kind of gave us a continuity of the importance of camera people and that kind of visual reportage in showing people what's going on in their lives and in their world. And this film, for that reason, is just a treasure. It's part of my nation's history. It shows that very well and very clearly. Yes, from a certain bias being from the left, but it doesn't show it. It shows it truthfully. It shows it using some of the best Australian actors of the time. I mean, there are any number of them. There's Johnny Hewitt, there's Brian Brown's in there, John Deese playing the guy who does the voiceover. John Deese was a voiceover guy back in the 1950s as well. Alexander Archdale, an Australian actor who had great success overseas. He was actually born in India. Don Crosby, other older actors, but also younger actors in there. You see people like Drew Forsyth in there. Steve Bisley's in there as well. Tony Barry, who I saw in an episode of Q&A late last year. Q&A is the political program here in Australia that's on once a week, and I usually get my tweets scrolled below the people talking, and Tony Barry turned up on that, talking about fairness in Australia, amongst other things. It's just one of those movies that brings everything together perfectly. And it does it in an incredibly entertaining way. I can't overhype this movie because I really think it is great. And I think they did it on a low budget. They did it with a lot of imagination, a lot of guts. The script's very good. They had a lot of script contribution from people who actually lived through those experiences, newsreel cameramen and people who'd worked for Sydney Sound News at the time. And, yeah, this movie is a joy. Again, it's in that special category that I'm not going to watch it too often, but I'm glad I own a copy of it. And I'm glad that I can recommend it to other people. I don't want it to kind of lose the wonderfulness, so I'm not going to watch it very often. But I did talk about it on ABC Radio in Darwin, and I got a very good response as well. People remember the movie with a great fondness, and they remember it as a cultural artifact. It's one of the movies that's been preserved by the Australian Film and Sound Archive for its cultural importance. But anyway, that's about it for the two movies. I did ask a question on Facebook, which I got some really interesting responses to, a movie-related question, because I'm not getting much direct feedback by email or voicemail, and again, that's your fault. I thought I'd throw a movie-related question out there to the masses and see what I get back. And the movie question I asked was, mostly I asked this to guys, though I did get some responses from women as well, but I wanted to really see what guys thought about this. And I asked people which movie makes them cry. And I wanted to find out which kind of movie makes guys cry. And I got some really interesting responses. I won't say who said what, but I'll just give you a little bit of an idea about the movies that people found made them tear up. I just read out the question as it was put to the people, then I'll do some of the replies. I've got 56 replies, which ain't too bad at all. It said, okay, guys, mostly guys, but women, feel free to answer too. Which movie makes you weepy every time? I have two, The Ending of Will Penny with Charlton Heston and The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. We got one from one of my fellow podcasters saying Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Someone said E.T., and then I went into an argument with them about that. Somebody else said Ghost and Steel Magnolias. That was from Jan, a female friend of mine. Let me have a look here. Somebody said their husband weeps at the end of Bicentennial Man with Robin Williams. Not going to understand that. Somebody else said Rain Over Me, The Sixth Sense. Notebook, I got that from one of my female friends. Green Mile, I got that from another one of my female friends. American History X, which was from my friend Philbo. Dead Poets Society, Philadelphia and Brian Song, Steel Magnolias in Terms of Endearment, Good Will Hunting, we got into a bit of that. Wally, Once Were Warriors, Regarding Henry. The Last of Us, video game, they've got that in there for some reason. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Grave of the Fireflies, Savior with Dennis Quaid in it, Rabbit Proof Fence, another film noise film, Soldier with Kurt Russell, and people keep saying don't judge me when they come off with off-the-wall ones, but I'm not going to judge anybody. I really don't want to do that. The Ending of Black Beauty Returns when they were very young, somebody said. Neverending Story, Terminator 2, The Constant Gardener. A certain scene in John Wick, the new Keanu Reeves movie, and the bit where Wilson floats away in Castaway, we got that as well. Let's see, Life is Beautiful and Still Crazy. The Iron Giant, we got that one as well. I'm just scrolling down. What Dreams May Come, somebody will like that. My friend Ryan liked that one. There are a lot of Robin Williams movies. Sophie's Choice, we got in there. Old Yeller. Let's see, when they sing the Marseillaise in Casablanca. Yeah, I can go with that one, Steve Sullivan. Last of the Mohicans, the Daniel Day-Lewis one, the end of the Muppet movie, and the first sign of the Enterprise in dry dock in Star Trek, the motion picture. Thank you, Garfield, for that one. I then added another one that I'd forgotten about, which was the Anton Warburg speech at the end of The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. I threw that one in there. The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, Grand Budapest Hotel. Yeah, I can go with that too. them documentaries. Somebody put them in a documentary, Memory of the Camps, and Schindler's List, if documentaries don't count. Yeah, documentaries count. That's okay, Bob. Let me have a look here. Slippers in Seattle, Longtime Companion. That was from my friend David in Minnesota, so thank you for that. Monsignor Quixote with Alec Guinness and Leo McKern. West Side Story, Toy Story 3, Man of La Mancha, Disney's The Jungle Book. I'm not sure about those ones. Somebody said they just watched Will Penny and they had something in their eye too. Brief Encounter, another one. So, yeah, I can go with that. Saving Mr. Banks and Leslie Nielsen at the end of Naked Gun. I'm not sure about that one, but I'll go with it. Let's see. Someone said there's a moment in any John Ford movie that chokes him up. That was from my friend Bruce. A Canterbury Tale, the Powell and Press Birmingham movie set during World War II. Somebody else said Grave of the Fireflies, Resurrection 1980. Somebody else said Death of Roy Batty in Blade Runner, Victoria Page in Red Shoes, the title character in King Kong, and the reunions of Cary Grant and Deborah Kerr in An Affair to Remember. And also the reunion of James Cagney and Anne Sheridan in City for Conquest, which I haven't seen, but which I've just added to the list. So that was a pretty good going there. I think the takeaway from this is people do get emotionally involved with movies in a lot of ways. I've got somewhere else I can look for answers to this one, so I'm just going to kill some time while I flick through the Facebook. If you want to frame me up on Facebook, please do. As long as you're not going to be a racist dickhead or an arsehole or a troll, I'm more than happy to friend up listeners, so you can find me there fairly easily. You shouldn't have too much trouble locating me. I'm just waiting for this to come through now, you see. So while I'm filling time, of course, the internet goes slow because that's what internet does. Whenever you want something to happen fast, it won't. When you don't give a shit, it will happen as quickly as you would like it to. Oh, we got up to 120 people liking the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So thank you to the 119 other people there. I'll keep posting weird things like the picture of Yves Montand I posted. And let me see, I've got a couple of other ones here. Matomatic said La Marseillaise from Casablanca. And let me have a look here. Nick Sauer said the movie Blow, at the end there's a scene that was kind of my worst nightmare, which ends up being a double whammy. He started crying in the cinema. And Diane felt terrible afterwards, Diane being his wife. Let's see, the original Night of the Meek in the episode of Twilight Zone, the scene with the two kids telling the drunk Santa that the only thing they want for Christmas is a new job for their daddy is more than he can handle. Yeah, I can see that. I mean, that's the interesting thing about getting weepy in movies. We get triggered by different things because of our life experience, and that ain't necessarily a bad thing. But I think that if you went through your life as a movie viewer and you never got emotionally involved enough in a movie to occasionally tear up a little bit, then you need to be checked out. You're probably a sociopath. It doesn't mean I won't friend you up on Facebook anyway, but you might want to get yourself checked out there, because I think that one of the lovely things that movies do is they engage our emotions when they're done well as much as they engage our minds. And that's kind of cool. I love movies that grab me. I don't care whether it's an incredibly intensely erotic scene that grabs me, whether it's somebody nursing a child in their arms, whether it's a joke that makes me laugh and makes me happier, whether it's something sad, whether it's something I've never seen before, whether it's a fuck moment. I love movies engaging me. And that's one of the reasons why I do this. I like to be surprised by movies. I hate movies that kind of go paint by the numbers and go through the motions of doing things. I think that's lazy. And I think if you're going to spend millions of dollars, the least you can do is make something interesting for everybody involved. But that's about it for this time around. Thank you for listening to the Australia Day episode. I think I might do one each January where I do look at a couple of Australian films, apart from any others I want to do. And to give a bit of a viewpoint on why I love the cinema of my country. But as I said, 2% of the listeners to this podcast are Australian. So I'm kind of talking to that 2% in some ways, but also trying to give the other 98% of people a bit of an idea about where I come from, where it comes to Australian cinema. But anyway, look after yourselves. I'll be back in another week with another Martian Drive-In podcast, which I'm looking forward to. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with a Paleo Cinema podcast. I have absolutely no fucking idea what I'm going to do for that. So if you have any ideas, pop them through. In fact, I might make that the question on Facebook, which movie should I cover that I haven't covered already? And I bet I'll get a whole bunch of answers on things I've already covered. But I'm going to throw it out there. Patreon campaign's still going. So if you go to patreon.com/paleocinema, there is a goodie box. I'm putting together a box of movie-related stuff, movies, movie-related gear, and all sorts of other little bits and pieces that I'm going to be giving away in April. I'm doing it on my birthday. I'm going to pull a name out of a hat of people who have contributed to the Patreon campaign. And wherever they are on this clay and granite planet, I will send them this box of stuff. Got no problem with that at all. The Patreon campaign is doing okay. I can afford postage once a year for stuff like this. And I do want to give back, and I want to encourage people to support me and also support other podcasters. Take a look at the people who've already subscribed to the Patreon campaign for Paleo Cinema. Some of them have their own Patreon campaigns, and I would really like you to support them nearly as much, but not quite as much, as I'd like you to support me. So, as usual, I'm going to leave you now with the credits for the people who have contributed to the campaign in the form of movie credits with the backing of Mr. Debussy on the piano. And once again, it's time to thank all of the Patreon podcast subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jane, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technical consultant, Matt-O-Matic, the rattlesnake wrangler, and our new one, Elaine, the scientific advisor. And I'd also like to thank Sally. She's the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thanks to all of the subscribers. And the music in the background you're hearing is Claude Debussy playing Gollywog's Cakewalk from a piano roll of his.